This is the takeaway for Wednesday, June 7th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is there anything more to learn about the Russia investigations in Washington? Well, the answer is a definite yes. But as for the hearings today on Capitol Hill, where four members of the intelligence community are testifying before the Senate, the answer looks to be a definite no. The cast of this episode of Trump, Russia, and the U.S. Constitution include acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who helped fire James Comey, the former FBI director, and NSA head Admiral Mike Rogers, also Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats. Additionally, we learned today that Christopher Wray, a former Justice Department official running the DOJ Criminal Division, seems to be the Trump choice to be the new FBI director. More on that in a moment. Joining me from Capitol Hill is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
What do you think about these hearings? Everyone's being very cautious.
John, one of the key questions in these hearings has been directed to Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, and to Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA. There have been press reports that both Coats and Rogers had conversations with the president at various times, that Rogers was asked by the president to push back on press reports, to essentially spin reporters and to tell reporters that there was no evidence of any collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russians. Likewise, press reports that Dan Coats was asked to do that, but that Dan Coats was also asked by the president to lean on James Comey when he was FBI director to get Comey to back off or back down of the Russia investigation at the FBI. Of course, we know that since then, James Comey has been fired. The president has said that the Russia investigation was on his mind when he fired Comey. James Comey will testify tomorrow all about that. Now, for his part, Dan Coats, the director of DNI, said that he was never pressured to do anything by anyone in the executive as relates to Russia. Roger said he was never ordered in his time at NSA to do anything illegal, unethical, or immoral. Remember those words. Coats said he was never pressured. Roger said he was never ordered. Then Marco Rubio, Republican senator from Florida, had some questions for Coats. Listen.
Dr. Coats, I would just say, and with incredible respect that I have for you, I am not asking for classified information. I am asking whether or not you have ever been asked by anyone to influence an ongoing investigation.
I understand, but I'm just not going to go down that road in a public forum. And I also was asked the question if the special prosecutor called upon me to meet with him to ask his questions. I said I would be willing to do that.
I likewise stand by my previous comment.
So does this leave us status quo, or does this suggest that we're going to learn a lot more when Comey sits down at the hearings tomorrow?
Well, we may learn a lot more when Comey sits down at the hearings tomorrow, but some of these exchanges with senators got increasingly contentious as senators tried to delve into what appeared to be parsed language from the DNI director Coats that he was never pressured to interfere by the president in the Russia investigation, or Roger's statement that he was never ordered to do so. Senators increasingly getting agitated and asking if they were ever asked to do it, or if there's no claim of executive privilege from the White House, which there isn't right now. Now, why they're not answering the question. Martin Heinrich is a Democrat on the committee, John. He's from New Mexico.
I'm just saying I don't think it's appropriate.
You can clear an awful lot up by simply saying that never happened.
I do not share with the general public conversations that I have with the president or many of my colleagues within the administration that I believe are should not be shared.
Well, I think your unwillingness to answer a very basic question speaks volumes.
So, Todd, you're describing a narrative which is an accelerating sense of uncooperation between the administration and both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate and House. Is that what's going on here? Is that the real news?
there are open hearings and there are closed hearings, and the witnesses have appeared to be saying they're a lot, they're willing to say a lot more, John, in closed sessions that are classified than they are in public hearings. Although senators are also extremely frustrated. Here's Angus King. He's an independent senator. He caucuses with the Democrats. He's from Maine. There is no White House claim of executive privilege here, and he wanted to know from both witnesses why they aren't answering Congress's questions if they've sworn an oath to do so.
Is there an invocation by the President of the United States of executive privilege? Is there or not?
Not that I'm aware of.
Then why are you not answering
our
questions?
Because I feel it is inappropriate, Senator.
What you feel isn't relevant, Admiral. What you feel isn't the answer. The answer is, why are you not answering the questions? Is it an invocation of executive privilege? If there is, then let's know about it. If there isn't, answer the questions.
I stand by the comments I've made. I'm not interested in repeating myself, sir.
Is it for him, though, Admiral Rogers, to evoke executive privilege? Is that something for more senior members of the administration to do? Or are we really getting a hint of what's going to be the big issue as this goes forward?
It is for the White House counsel and for ultimately the president himself to invoke executive privilege if there is an invocation to be offered. Mike Rogers said that he did have a conversation with the White House about whether they plan to invoke executive privilege, John, about his testimony. He said he never got a definitive answer about that. And then you hear there the frustration from senators about why they're not answering questions that apparently don't contain classified information about their conversations with the president. Angus King, that senator you just heard there, went on to ask Dan Coats, the director of DNI, what was his legal basis for refusing to answer the question of if he had ever been asked by the president to intervene with James Comey about Russia. Coates said, I'm not sure I have a legal basis for not answering that question.
You know what's so interesting to me is that when the Supreme Court nominee Gorsuch was thinking about his confirmation hearing, it was, you know, presumed to be, you know, a respectful but possibly contentious hearing. Christopher Wray going before the House and Senate, or going before his confirmation hearing in Congress, I mean, he faces folks who are already so chilly and angry. I mean, can you imagine such a thing?
You're about to imagine it, because Christopher Wray apparently will face a confirmation hearing, since he is going to be apparently nominated as the new FBI director. Initial reactions to that possible nomination, John, are positive from both Republicans and Democrats. But if you think there's anger and chilliness about some of the process here, I can tell you that that's likely to continue, because when the president tweeted this morning, John, in the minutes before these hearings were going to start, that he was nominating Christopher Wray to be FBI director, John, no one on Capitol Hill knew about it. Not even the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, said it was a surprise to him. Dianne Feinstein, a surprise to her. All of the Republicans and Democrats who were asked, nobody knew about it. That's highly irregular. It appears that the president just said it.
Great stuff, Todd. And of course, I love it. On Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
You bet, John.
As to the other big story today, a presumptive nominee for FBI Director Christopher Wray. He looks to be very confirmable. He's got a lot of Justice Department experience, but he's also a very close professional associate of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, even representing him in the famous Bridgegate investigation. For more on all that, we turn to Andrea Bernstein, WNYC reporter on politics and policy. Andrea, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, John.
Do you think this is a Chris Christie suggestion here?
Well, it's very unclear. Christie has refused to say what the connection is. And we do know that Chris Christie has this long-running bad blood with presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner, and that Kushner saw to it that Christie wasn't involved in a meaningful way in his administration. So all we have is their denials. I mean, we know that Wray was a lawyer who represented Chris Christie privately during Bridgegate, as Christie's entitled to have a lawyer, Ray's entitled to represent him. And we know that they worked together in the Justice Department, Christie said, particularly on a case involving Bristol-Myers Squibb, which was part of a controversial practice Christie had when he was U.S. attorney, of allowing companies to negotiate non-prosecution agreements where they would have to give money or pay some kind of fee. So Christie said they worked together on that. So that is what we know about their relationship. So far in the Trump administration, we haven't seen evidence that a Christie recommendation is a positive thing. But of course, it's changing by the minute.
Well, forget Christie then. What about someone who ran the DOJ criminal division? What does that say for how the FBI shall be run under the Trump administration?
Right. So I've spoken to some prosecutors and former prosecutors this morning, and the reaction seems to be, on the one hand, here is somebody who really has experience working for a law enforcement agency. Unlike, say, Joe Lieberman, who was somebody that Trump said at one point was his favorite. But on the other hand, there's skepticism. He worked there for 8 years. He has to run an office of 10,000 people and be able to stand up to Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump, and Vladimir Putin. So there's some question about whether his resume and his background support that kind of an effort.
Although, you know, there's a management question there, as you describe all the people at the FBI. He's not an investigator, and I'm wondering if that carries any weight with the employees or affects morale in any way.
I mean, the morale from people I've spoken to is very, very bad.
Right.
People who are former FBI agents, former prosecutors, are unbelievably upset. The level of emotion that they're expressing is like nothing I have ever seen from this community.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I mean, I think there's probably a sigh of relief that it's not somebody who was a full-time politician, but there's fear and concern, and it's obviously coming in the context where we now know that President Trump not only tried directly with Comey to get him to drop his investigation, but also spoke to senior intelligence officials inside his administration. That's the atmosphere that this FBI chief is walking into.
Yeah, Christopher Wray will have plenty to do as he starts, but people who spoke with me or emailed me about him suggested that he's got a lot of learning to do, that this is going to be a heavy lift for him to get up to speed quickly. And so in theory, that means Deputy McCabe is going to be training the fellow who's essentially replacing him as acting FBI director.
Unlike, say, Mueller or Louis Free, he is not a lifelong G-man.
Right.
He is somebody who has worked in the Justice Department, but has also worked in private practice. And his law partner is, in fact, an ethics advisor to Donald Trump. So there is that connection there. I mean, I think what we know are the facts before us, where here is a man who has to be investigating things like we have never had to investigate
exactly
before in this context, who is somebody who does not come out of a lifelong tradition of investigation and national leadership.
Andrea Bernstein is the senior editor for politics and policy for WNYC News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The break in diplomatic relations in the Gulf claims to be about some revelation regarding Qatar's support for terrorism, although how this is a revelation when it is something of an open secret that the rich Gulf nations all permit their citizens to support favored causes that may end up funding violence is a bit of a mystery. And just how much the Trump administration is tweeting up a storm about all this and playing with fire in the Gulf region is another issue likely to be examined on Capitol Hill this week. It's fire literally in the Iranian capital today, with multiple terror attacks plus a suicide bombing and armed assault on the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini. ISIS has claimed responsibility. Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News in Istanbul, joins us to explain the role of competition over leadership between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and all the many dangerous flashpoints here. Welcome, Borzu.
It's a pleasure.
So there's a lot going on here. First of all, the Tehran attacks, ISIS taking responsibility for them. Could that be obviously linked to Qatar or to what's been going on diplomatically in the region?
Yeah, I'm sure some people are going to say that. I'm sure that ISIS seeks to exploit rifts in the region in planning its operations. But this was obviously the kind of operation that you can't just pull off overnight. This was weeks, possibly months in the planning. It probably involved, you know, very, you know, extensive levels of recruitment, of procurement of weapons, of smuggling people and weapons into Tehran. That's not a joke. This thing with Qatar happened 2 days ago. So I don't see it in that way as linked. But it just underscores the insane amount of chaos in this kaleidoscope of conflict.
How much of the Qatari emir's support for Iran is an open secret, and how much of its support for Hezbollah and Hamas, et cetera?
I mean, it doesn't, you know, Qatar plays an interesting diplomatic game. Qatar does not support Iran. Qatar does not support Hamas. Qatar does not support, definitely does not support Hezbollah. It maintains ties with everyone. It maintains contacts with everyone. It occasionally hosts people in Qatar or gives them a platform on Qatari media who belong to populist Islamist movements that the Gulfies don't like, that the UAE and Saudi Arabia don't like. And it has, you know, pretty good relations with Iran, if only because the two countries share the largest gas field on the planet. And so, you know, they better have good relations, or, you know, not only is business going to suffer, but, you know, the entire energy market of the globe would suffer if those relations became sour. And I think that the Gulf understands that. But what they accuse the Qataris of doing is just being way too independent in terms of their foreign policy, of, you know, doing things that the Gulfies just don't like consistently.
The Gulfies? I mean, who are they? The Gulfies?
I mean, by the Gulfies, I mean Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and so on. Basically, they are the ones of the Persian Gulf kind of leadership. They don't like the way that Qatar is doing its foreign policy. On the other hand, you have Oman, which also has, you know, even to some extent, better relations with Iran, is part of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and Kuwait, which has, you know, very cordial relations with Iran. And, you know, they're not going after these guys. It's not so much the Iran issue that is upsetting the Saudis. It's just the whole package in general of Qatar and how it behaves in the region.
But it is the case that each one of these nations has a set of military missions that they're involved with one way or another in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, whether it's, Zakat support for certain groups. What's all that about?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Everyone's got, like, their little dirty dealings with everyone, you know. I mean, there hasn't been a terror attack here in Turkey, in Istanbul, since January, and there was consistently terror attacks. I mean, do you think that's a coincidence? Or, you know, was there some kind of gentleman's agreement indirectly made between Turkey and the leaders of various jihadi groups not to do their dirty work here in Turkey for a while? You know, you never know. But there's many, many signs that there's this sort of kind of unspoken alliances, unspoken partnership. There's allegations, for example, that Saudi's partners in the conflict in Yemen include elements of Al-Qaeda, you know. But the rift between Qatar and the UAE and Saudi Arabia is more about like a philosophy that we're going to do our own thing. Qatar is going to do its own thing. It's not going to coordinate with the other Arab countries. It's going to ignore what Saudi Arabia wants. Saudi Arabia is the big kid on the block, so to speak, and it's trying to impose its will.
The focus of the U.S. president on tweeting out that this is part of some, you know, grand scheme to reduce terrorism in the region, is this plague with fire as well? I mean, Iran.
I think it is on some level, on multiple levels, because, you know, first of all, we have like 10,000 troops stationed in Qatar. They've been a pretty good ally to us, to the U.S. And, you know, most, if not most of the air operations that are being conducted over Syria and Iraq are coordinated out of central command in Doha, in Qatar. So I thought that was like a pretty risky thing to do, is to start, you know, insulting the leaders of that country and so on. And here's where Russia did come in, you know, just like hours after those tweets that Donald Trump issued, basically insulting and, downgrading and degrading Qatar, which has been an ally for like, you know, I don't know how many decades to the U.S. You know, the Kremlin issued a statement saying that, you know, guess what? I just had a nice chat with the emir of Qatar. So this is where, you know, it creates opportunities for other players, including Iran and possibly Turkey, to come in and provide Qatar the security guarantees that it doesn't seem to get from the U.S.
Orzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He spoke to us from Istanbul in Turkey. Thanks so much, Orzu.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
In a literary quiz, you might guess James Baldwin or Langston Hughes or Zora Neale Hurston or even Maya Angelou if the question was, who was the first African-American writer to win a Pulitzer Prize? And you would be wrong.
I've stayed in the front yard all my life. I want to peek at the back, where it's rough and untended and hungry weed grows. A girl gets sick of a rose. I want to go in the backyard now and maybe down the alley to where the charity children play. I want a good time today.
These are the words of Gwendolyn Brooks, A Song in the Front Yard. The poem documents the struggles of African Americans in Chicago. It's from her first book, A Street in Bronzeville, which became an instant success in 1945. This eloquent, fierce, complex, but accessible poet was a national literary treasure for decades. She also changed poetry, according to Peter Kahn, veteran English teacher and spoken word educator at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago. Brooks would have been 100 today, and in her honor, Kahn has co-edited a collection of poems called The Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. Golden Shovel refers to a special form of poetry like haikus or limericks that follow a hard and fast set of rules.
So the rules, so to speak, are that one would borrow a line or an entire poem from Ms. Brooks or occasionally from someone else they want to honor and run it down the right margin of a new poem that they create. What's beautiful about it is it allows someone to go and rediscover the work of one of their favorite poets or discover new work and see how it can inspire the work that they're writing. So for my students, many of whom are very apprehensive when it comes to writing poetry, to start out with someone else's poem who they respect and honor, to then be able to borrow from that gives them a little boost in confidence, and it makes it more than just writing a poem. It's also paying homage to somebody else.
What's the interest in Gwendolyn Brooks and other poets that you're trying to teach right now?
First of all, I hated reading poetry and I hated teaching poetry for a long time.
That's a good beginning. Right.
And I worked, when I was a social worker, I worked with someone named Quraysh Ali Lansana, who had been mentored by Ms. Brooks, was being mentored by Ms. Brooks at the time. It was 1992. And he introduced me to her work, and I sat behind her at his wedding, in fact. But a particular poem, We Real Cool, which is often anthologized, he showed me how to use it to teach. So when I finally started enjoying teaching poetry in the late 90s, I would reference that poem with my students to show them how there's this extra tool in a poet's toolbox that doesn't exist in a fiction writer's toolbox in terms of these unnatural line breaks. And I use a recording of Ms. Brooks so that they could hear her saying it and emphasizing the word we, even though the we followed a period in each line. So to show what an unnatural line break looks like, sounds like, and what it can do for a poem. And in terms of being in Oak Park, being in Illinois, I had a student who, when he was in elementary school, Ms. Brooks came to his school and he won some prize and he got to meet her. And I remember when she passed away, he was probably in his early 20s, he sent me an email or even a letter saying how much that it hurt that she's no longer in the world, and how that was a highlight of his life, was getting to spend time with Ms. Brooks. And her daughter talks about how when she was Poet Laureate of Illinois, she would go into schools and she might stay after school for 2 or 3 hours signing autographs and talking to the kids. So I think in this day and age, to have that kind of legacy is just a really beautiful thing. And I think people, particularly with her centenary now, are honoring that legacy.
You know, I hear in your voice a sense of real personal responsibility to carry this on, to push this forward. Is it difficult as a teacher to connect the poetic legacy and aesthetic of Gwendolyn Brooks in her time with the more popular idioms, say hip-hop, which are poetic but don't necessarily connect with traditional literature and poetry?
Well, I'll tell you this. When we read these three Brooks poems in our spoken word club, there were plenty of snaps for striking lines, right?
So really?
When kids get up and read their own poems or reading other people's poems and there's a striking line, kids will snap, right? That's the spoken word tradition. And they were snapping and oohing and aahing at the beauty of Ms. Brooks's writing. So I think her writing is as relevant today as it was when she wrote it.
Do you think students will carry this forward, whether it's using her work or other poetic works that get integrated into this kind of snap freestyle world of popular culture?
I mean, that's one of my biggest hopes with this anthology, and that's shared with my co-editors Ravi Shankar and Patricia Smith, is that this gets in a bunch of classrooms and kids and college students are inspired to utilize this form and to dig into the work of Ms. Brooks and dig into the work of other writers and see how they can integrate that work into creating something that's telling, you know, the new authors' stories about what's going on in their lives and what's going on in the world. So to me, that's one of the biggest reasons for putting this book out into the world. And it has, you know, about 20 people who are students when they wrote it, who are my students or former students in it, alongside a Rita Dove or a Billy Collins. So part of that was just kind of even the playing field, because this isn't a sonnet where there's hundreds of years of people writing it. This is a brand new form, so it's less intimidating in that regard. And I think that will make it more effective in the classroom.
What Gwendolyn Brooks poem do you most like to read and feel most emotionally empowered to sing out?
Well, the poem that I wrote my poem inspired by was Kitchenette Building, and quite a few people in the anthology wrote from that poem. So that's probably my favorite. We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan, grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes, its white and violet, fight and fried potatoes, and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall, flutter or sing an aria down these rooms, even if we were willing to let it in, had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin. We wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number 5 is out of the bathroom now, we think of lukewarm water, hope to get in it.
Oh, so nice. Peter Kahn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Kahn is an English teacher and spoken word educator at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago. Here are some of his students reading Brooks' works.
They do some wonderful things. They have some wonderful fun.
My mother sneers.
But I say it's fine.
They don't have to go in at 8:45. My mother, she tells me that Johnny May will grow up to be a bad woman.
And
I'd like to be a bad woman, too.
I'd wear the brave stockings of night black lace and strut down the streets with paint on my face.
By the way, the Golden Shovel poetry style was created by Terrence Hayes, co-editor of the Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks, who would have been a century old today. She was a poetry consultant to the Library of Congress and the poet laureate of the state of Illinois from 1969 until her death in the year 2000. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The grisly, live-streamed police shooting death of Philando Castile last year is now a trial of both police officer Geronimo Yanez, who is accused of manslaughter and other serious charges after responding to a traffic stop last July, and it's a trial on the value of live-stream testimony evidence. Castile, who had a legal permit to carry a handgun, was shot to death when, according to Officer Yanez's defense, Castile was reaching for his weapon, but according to his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, he was actually reaching for his identification. Reynolds, a passenger in the car, along with her 4-year-old daughter, live-streamed the tragic aftermath with her cell phone.
We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him.
Jurors yesterday watched that video as well as new footage from the police dash camera. Yanez is being charged with second-degree manslaughter and 2 felony counts for reckless discharge of a firearm. He's thought to be the first police officer in Minnesota to be criminally charged in a police shooting.
Reham Fashir is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio News and co-host of the podcast 74 Seconds. That 74 seconds is the amount of time that elapsed between the moment Officer Yanez turned on his squad car lights to the seventh and final shot fired into Castile's car.
Today is day 7 of the trial, and after a week of jury selection last week, testimony started 2 days ago. And it started with Diamond Reynolds. She was the closest witness to the shooting and the woman who live-streamed the aftermath. She was on the stand for quite a while, questioned by the prosecution and cross-examined by the defense. And Yanez's partner at the time also testified.
And is Reynolds viewed as a responsible witness here, and does the live stream bolster her credibility? Does it create an argument for the defense? I'm very interested to know how the defense for this officer is placing this live streamed information in context.
Well, she was questioned for a while by the prosecution, and they played her the Facebook Live video along with the dash cam video. And they did provide additional evidence to confirm her testimony as far as what she did that day. The defense questioned her for quite a while. They cross-examined her for a while. And during that testimony, they tried to point out inconsistencies in some of the statements that she'd made in terms of where Philando Castile carried his wallet, whether it was on the right side or the left side, whether he was trying to unbuckle his seatbelt or was he trying to reach for a wallet. They also talked a lot about marijuana. Marijuana has been an issue that has come up over and over in some of these pretrial filings. So they questioned her on whether she knew there was marijuana in the car or not, and if she was the one that bought the marijuana or if it was Philando Castile that bought the marijuana. Those are the types of things that they questioned her on.
What's the community's response to all of this, and how closely are they paying attention?
Well, the courtroom is usually packed. There are so many people, you know, sitting on both sides. There are plenty of reporters covering this trial. The judge is very strict. He issued an order saying there should be no facial expressions, no reactions, and also no protesting or any gatherings outside the courtroom. So we haven't seen any of that. And Castile's family has been very careful not to comment on anything during this trial because they want to make sure that Officer Yanez gets a fair trial.
Reham Fashir is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio News. She's also co-host of the podcast 74 Seconds on Minnesota Public Radio News and American Public Media. Reham, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Energy has become the front line in the battle for tribal rights versus federal energy policy and private sector construction. The state of Minnesota and its residents are beginning a formal process to decide the future of the Enbridge pipeline. It's operated by Calgary-based Enbridge Energy Partners that wants to upgrade the pipeline and reroute it. The pipeline currently runs from Hallock, North Dakota, through Clearbrook, Minnesota, eastward to Superior, Wisconsin. And the switch will carry the oil across Ojibwe tribal lands. The nearly 24 public hearings are meant to fully debate the value of tribal rights, energy safety, and prized jobs in a high-paying industry. Dan Crocker is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, covering the northeastern part of the state, and he attended one of the hearings in Grand Rapids, Minnesota last night. Dan, joining us from Duluth, can this process prevent a Standing Rock confrontation like we saw last year?
Well, that remains to be seen. I spoke to Winona LaDuke yesterday, who is one of the main opponents of this pipeline. She is an Ojibwe leader. She runs a nonprofit called Honor the Earth.
We've been very clear with the state representatives and the governor of Minnesota that if they approve this lawn, there will be tens of thousands of people in Minnesota. You know, a lot of us came from Minnesota and went to Standing Rock, and we certainly know how to camp. They should just have the courage and say, don't build it. We're worth more. You know, everybody wants to know what is happening now. After Standing Rock, what is happening now? And this is the next big battle.
Whether that remains to be seen, we will see. But there are a lot of parallels between this and the Standing Rock protests that occurred over in the Dakotas.
Why divert the pipeline and have it run onto Ojibwe land when we had such a difficult period of time with Standing Rock?
The route that Enbridge is looking at does not cross over any Indian reservation land. It does, what's contentious is it does cross over land that was once held by Ojibwe people but was since ceded to the federal government in a treaty in the 1800s. The Ojibwe, however, maintain that they still have hunting, fishing, gathering rights on that land. And indeed, this land has some of the best wild rice waters in the state and really North America. And so wild rice plays a really touchstone role in Ojibwe culture. And there's a lot of fear that a potential spill would do serious damage to that resource.
And where is that rice harvested?
It's harvested on lakes and streams and backwaters throughout north-central Minnesota.
So if any oil spilled into those lakes and rivers, it would be, boom, end of the harvest immediately.
For that year, at least. I mean, wild rice is very sensitive. And that's part of what this environmental impact statement, the study, is looking at the different risks involved and potential effects on resources, but also socioeconomic impacts like jobs and so forth for building this pipeline.
Have not so much tribal lands, but have wild rice harvesters coexisted, harvesters who aren't Native Americans in any way, have they coexisted with energy infrastructure and with a safety record that makes it possible to do both?
Yeah, that's what's interesting, John. There are currently five pipelines that Enbridge runs through this part of the state, and they've been doing it for over 50 years. They bring about 2.5 million barrels of oil a day currently. So wild rice harvesting has existed throughout the past, you know, several decades. As these pipelines have become more contentious, this has become much more heated, and the risk, you know, especially with what happened in Kalamazoo, Michigan, with the spill in the river there several years ago, there's just a lot of fear that something similar to that could happen here if this pipeline's allowed to go through.
From here on out, because of the effectiveness of Standing Rock, is virtually any energy decision on infrastructure, pipelines, et cetera, drilling, mineral rights, suddenly going to be on the table? Even if mineral rights have been theoretically ceded to the federal government back in history?
Well, that's what it looks like here. I mean, the combination of climate change and the activism that's occurring around climate change with Keystone XL combined with this newfound tribal resurgence that we saw over at Standing Rock, I mean, those two factors together really suggest that this next battle, as Winona LaDuke called it, is going to continue.
Dan Crocker is a reporter covering northeastern Minnesota for Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The whole war on obesity is a war on people.
It's not going to be easy. It's going to be an uphill battle.
We are really not healthy.
I want to be taken seriously, no matter what my weight.
So you're always in like this low-level crisis, pitting your regular bills against whether or not you're going to buy healthy food for your kids.
So obesity is a complex disease.
The question is, do we have an environment that supports responsible decision?
And is a greater public health challenge than anything else, in any virus, any other disease, and even terrorism.
What is it that gives kids the idea, the feeling, the suggestion that part of every day should include snacks and treats and yummy desserts and second helpings or even thirds? Yesterday we heard from Dr. Kelly Brownell, and one of the things he told us is that food marketers live to deliver this message to kids 24/7.
The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has been the primary funder of work in the country on childhood obesity, and has been spending close to $100 million on this now for a number of years. The food industry spends $100 million every year by January 4th, just marketing, just unhealthy foods, just to children.
So as you can see, public health doctors haven't a prayer of competing with food marketers, and kids haven't much of a chance of ever hearing a healthy message out of the noise of sweet offerings from the food industry.
Children see a massive number of food advertisements every year. The advertisements are no longer just on TV, but they're coming at kids through the internet and social media and any other number of ways, many of which are hard for parents to monitor or control.
Today in our series, Dr. Sarah Abiola, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, talks to Mary Harris, reporter for WNYC's Health News Desk and co-host of the podcast Only Human. Mary Harris and Dr. Abiola discuss that food and beverage companies have found never-fail ways of reaching kids.
I want to start with this video that came out a few years back, which I think you've seen, called Hot Cheetos and Takis.
And we gonna show y'all what we be snacking on. You dig? Okay. Hot Cheetos and Takis.
So it's a super charming rap performed by these really little kids.
Got my fingers stained red and I cannot get them off me. You can catch me in my coat eating hot Cheetos and Takis. Pop.
So when you saw this begin to go viral, what did you think?
Well, it's just kind of an example of what we know has been happening for quite some time, which is that young people, they're really kind of forming identities, forming networks, forming preferences as a result of the communication that's happening on social media. The food industry and the beverage industry in particular are really engaged in that space and using social media, using digital media as a means to engage in really novel marketing campaigns that are not that expensive but have potentially vast impacts.
What do you make of that?
I should start by saying there's kind of a long history of trying to regulate advertisers and to regulate the food and beverage industry as it relates to their behavior towards children. So we understand that children are not always able to determine when they're being exposed to persuasive material. And in addition to that, they're seeing it in every platform in which they're engaged. Their cell phones, their online, video games. So how do you begin to develop a message or a set of regulations or guidelines that help to make sure that children are being exposed to messages that are going to be health promoting as opposed to messages that encourage them to eat food with no nutritional value? So there have been aggressive campaigns by federal agencies like the FTC, for example, to say we want to set some minimum guidelines when it comes to the types of foods that can be advertised to children. And let's just say those did not end well at all. There was very organized pushback by the industry to really eliminate the ability to say that, for example, any product marketed to children would need to actually fall within an identifiable food group. Unfortunately, most of the foods that are marketed most heavily to children wouldn't meet that criteria.
Well, it sounds like we're really stuck because we can't control the advertising, the traditional advertising that's on TV. And then now we have this whole other thing, which is kids advertising to each other and themselves as kind of ground up social network. It seems kind of grim.
I think grim is accurate if we think about it solely from the perspective of regulation. I think that there are a number of young people who, number one, are aware that excess weight and excess fat is a problem to be addressed. So for a long time, there was kind of a concern that in certain communities, excess weight or obesity wasn't really perceived as a problem. I think increasingly through social media, where we see young African-American and young Latino women who are, really making strides when it comes to changing their lifestyle and changing their eating behaviors. And so a lot of these young women on social media who are sharing their journey through online videos on platforms like YouTube, for example, that they then also stream on Facebook, is to say, look, I started at, a very disadvantaged position. I weighed, 300 or 400 pounds, and I didn't have a nutritionist. I didn't have a physical trainer, and I was able to do it.
Hello, YouTube. My name is Shonda, and today is day two of my commitment to lose 300 pounds.
Now, these examples are viewed by hundreds of thousands, in some cases, millions of people, right? So we know that there's a lot of people who have seen these videos, and many of them will kind of come and say, I feel so inspired just because I've seen you do this. I feel I can do it. I feel like I can relate. So it's almost like you have a kind of community-generated biggest loser. Now, that's hopeful in terms of really thinking that young people can start to perceive that they have the capacity to change. But it doesn't really address the kind of broader picture of how we kind of leverage social media generally or how we begin to regulate the use of social media in the context of advertising to really change it. But it does give me hope that there are people who are kind of out there who are sharing their stories, who are very persuasive when it comes to making the argument that with time, with patience, with dedication, you can actually make a difference.
Sarah Abiola is an assistant professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples. It's pro time.